Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the Trump tax plan, hailed today by House Speaker Paul Ryan as, quote, a very important and special moment for the middle class, when it is clear that the main beneficiaries are the super rich and corporate America. Pavlina Cheneva, a professor of economics and chair of the economics department at Bard College, who is a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, joins us to discuss the Republican sleight of hand as they do the bidding of their donor class while selling a bill of goods to their voters, who will bear the increased burden as they pay more taxes while the debt and deficit explode. We will also examine the choice of Jerome Powell as the new Fed chairman, which appears to be an unusually reasonable choice by Trump, whose previous picks for high government posts are all hostile to the notion of government itself and are destroying the government departments they head up as they deconstruct Steve Bannon's mythical administrative state. Then, with a civil war poised to break out in America on Saturday, November the 4th, a violent insurrection led by Antifa super soldiers out to kill Trump voters, conservatives, and gun owners, all this according to alt-right websites and conspiracy monger Alex Jones. We will speak with Spencer Sunshine, a researcher and activist whose research interests include U.S. white nationalism, post-war fascism, left-right crossover movements, and left-wing anti-Semitism. He joins us to explore this paranoid fantasy that could have real-world consequences, since so many right-wing gun nuts in the country believe this nonsense. We will discuss how a demonstration by Chairman Bob Avakian's Revolutionary Communist Party that blocked a Los Angeles freeway with a sign that said, November 4, it begins, has morphed into an apocalyptic call for right-wing vigilantes to kill left-wing activists trying to spark a civil war. Then finally, we'll examine the hearings that took place in the last few days on Capitol Hill, in which representatives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter were grilled by lawmakers concerned that the tech giants allowed Russian fake news to influence the last election, and unless something is done, the Russians will interfere even more with the next election. Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School of Communication at USC and author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, joins us along with Mark Rotenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Network, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. And joining us now is Pavlina Cheneva, who is a professor of economics at Bard College and also the chair of the economics department at Bard College. She served as an associate director for economic analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability and has been a research scholar at the Levy's Economic Institute and is the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, the Macroeconomic Vision. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pavlina Cheneva.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
And what do you make of, I want to talk to you about the Fed announcement of Jerome Powell as the new Fed chairman, but before, the big story is the so-called tax reform bill that was announced today to great fanfare. The House Speaker, Paul Ryan, is referring to it as a great day for America and for the American middle class, and that you can now you can put do your taxes on a postcard. But my sense is that this is a bit of sleight of hand that's going on here, that the Republicans are satisfying their donor class, the very ultra-wealthy, the plutocrats, if you will, at the same time trying to sell this bill of goods to their voters, the middle class, who are going to end up paying more and having to face a even greater debt and deficit over the long term.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it. It's a great marketing strategy to rebrand the donor class, the middle class. I mean, this is the same old story. In economics, we call it trickle-down economics. But it's that old and really defunct idea that somehow if you provide incentives or tax cuts to the wealthiest households, then that's going to translate into robust growth or job creation. And this, you know, we've seen this experiment in real life in the 80s, and we know exactly what the results are from these types of tax cuts. What we have today is essentially a policy that makes the tax system less progressive, that provides big cuts to, yes, corporations and especially wealthiest households. And the era of trickle-down economics in the 80s had one major result, and that was increasing inequality. And so we basically are doing more of the same. We are supporting the incomes of those who do extraordinarily well in the economy, and we are forgetting the vast majority of households which really have not seen any income growth, real income growth, for the last 30 years. So let me just say this again. For the last 30 years, the majority of U.S. households, their real purchasing power has remained the same. And so this tax plan does nothing to reverse this trend.
And I know the state and local tax deduction has gone, and that seems like political spitefulness to hurt the successful blue states that vote Democrat, like New York and California. What happened with the pass-through? Because that's going to explode the deficit, isn't it?
Well, so there are several arguments that we can make about this tax plan, why it is bad. The one that I'm making is that it's just bad economics. But the fact that it's going to explode the deficit, in my view, is not the correct argument to put forth against this plan. Here's why I say this. I actually think that there's nothing wrong with increasing the deficit per se. What that means in simple terms is that the government is spending, let's say, $100 billion, but it's taking back only 80, which means that the remaining 20, what we call the deficit, remain somewhere in the real economy. The question here is, whose pockets are they in? So under the current plan, this plan will increase the deficit, and most likely it will benefit the wealthiest households. Now, this is an argument against this tax plan. But suppose that there was a tax plan that put a lot of money in the pockets of the vast majority of households. Suppose that it was a tax cut, like, let's say, a payroll tax cut, that put more money in the 90% of households. Then that in and of itself is probably a good thing in the current situation. So the deficit, the exploding of the deficit per se, I will not use that as an argument against the tax plan. I will ask the question, who does it benefit?
Well, I can answer at least one part of the tax plan. That's repealing the inheritance taxes on multi-million dollar estates above combined husband and wife threshold of $11 million. There's not too many people have more than $11 million in terms of their estate. And that is a clear giveaway to the uber rich.
Exactly. Exactly. This is exactly the right argument against the tax plan. I mean, we're talking about 0.2% of households. I mean, it is a clear, as you said, giveaway to the donor class. We already have a huge problem with donations, you know, political contributions, with the donor class's outsized influence over our democracy. This doesn't help the situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Pavlina Cheneva, who is a professor of economics and the chair of the economics department at Bard College. So tell me, how are they going to sell this? Because it's not exactly, you know, I mean, for example, they've got the realtors and the Home Builders Association who have a lot of influence across the country. They're gearing up against them. So how do you see this thing progressing?
Well, it's not clear what the alliances are going to be. So far Trump has had difficulty passing pretty much every one of his proposals. We have to watch it very cautiously, because there are far too many people who are both on the left and the right who would love to have a big tax cut. So the donor class is not exclusively Republican, and so we need to see where the alliances would forge. The problem with the exemption, eliminating the state and local tax exemption, is also a very big problem. You know, Republicans will have a hard time selling this in New York and New Jersey. And, you know, this is a pretty clear way of of impacting the middle class. Life is already very expensive in these coastal states, and now those middle-income households are not able to deduct those taxes on their federal forms. But then, you know, there are those at the very, very bottom of the income distribution, sort of the forgotten, the ones that make meager income below $10,000. And for them, the tax rate actually increases from 10 to 12%. Now, they need a voice in Congress, and hopefully there will be a considerable pushback. But I am of the opinion that we need a bold fiscal push. We do probably need a bigger deficit in the current situation. It's just not this kind. You know, I'd much rather see a bold jobs program. There has been some talk about infrastructure investment. So who knows what the negotiation will be behind closed doors and whether this tax plan ends up being passed in exchange for something that is a lot more progressive. But again, I'm not holding my breath here.
Well, just in the last few minutes then, what's it going to do for the middle class? Because Paul Ryan again said it's very clear and obvious that the purpose of this is a middle class tax cut. I don't see that.
But it is not. It is not. We have run through this experiment after the Reagan era. Before the 80s, when the economy grows, that growth goes to the vast majority of households. You know, the vast majority of the growth in income, in GDP, in output, has always gone to the vast majority of households, 90%. In the 80s, something profound changes. Our distribution of income changes completely. Whenever an economy expands, virtually all of the growth goes to the top sliver of households. This is the era of this type of trickle-down economics. And so it is possible that this tax cut extends a little bit the recovery. But what it does, it essentially undermines the income distribution in the U.S., which is already drastically eroded. And so it really puts in motion these long-term processes that are very hard to reverse. So I expect more income inequality as a consequence of this plan.
Well, just in the last minute, Trump has announced that Jerome Powell will be the new Fed chairman. It seems at least a rational choice. He's made, he's put Drucker in charge of the blood bank in just about every government department. But in this case, he seems to have made a rational choice. Does that mean he's not going to screw with Wall Street?
Well, I think that the reason why it looks like it's rational is because he doesn't want to rattle financial markets. I mean, the one policy that maintains sort of status quo and continuity is the appointment of Powell. I think Janet Yellen was a superior choice. And though Powell follows in her footsteps and does not represent a major shift in policy, he is, at the end of the day, a Wall Street insider in ways that Janet Yellen is not. She was, as a scholar and as a Fed official, far more concerned with labor markets and issues of income distribution. So while I don't expect any major changes in interest rate policy, Powell is friendly to Wall Street, which for Wall Street is good right now, but also he has suggested that he is open to loosening some of the Dodd-Frank regulations that were put in place after 2008. He is not a very aggressive deregulator, but nevertheless, he's probably more, he has more deregulatory posture than Janet Yellen, who said, you know, resilience is still our number one goal. And so it remains to be seen.
Well, Pavlina Chernyeva, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Pavlina Chernyeva, who is a professor of economics and chair of the economics department at Bard College. She served as associate director for economic analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability and has been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and is the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, the Macroeconomic Vision. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the civil war that's poised to break out in America this Saturday, November the 4th, all according to Alex Jones and alt-right websites.
outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Spencer Sunshine, who's a researcher and activist whose research interests include U.S. white nationalism, post-war fascism, particularly third position and European new right politics, left-right crossover movements, and left-wing anti-Semitism. As an activist, he's worked on issues regarding anti-fascism, police misconduct, prisoners' rights, global trade agreements, and environmental issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Spencer Sunshine.
Thank you for having me back on the show.
Well, thank you, Spencer. And so I understand that on Saturday, November the 4th, America's going to descend into a civil war and that the far right are preparing for it based upon an extraordinary myth that the Antifa groups have mobilized to start killing Trump supporters.
That is the conspiracy theory that has spread like wildfire through the far right.
And I take it the main amplifier of that conspiracy theory has been Alex Jones.
He is the main amplifier. It had started earlier, but once he picked it up, I think it really, like a lot of different people, picked it up.
So can you just explain what it is they think is going to happen?
Sure. So on November 4th, a left-wing group called Refuse Fascism is calling for there to be demonstrations that will, they want to use as this start to get rid of Donald Trump. They're hoping people will engage in nonviolent protests and it will build day after day, perhaps like Occupy or like what happened in Tahrir Square in Egypt. The far right has picked up on this call and Refuse Fascism. They have followers, but they're not a huge group, and they don't have a lot of allies. It's not an idea that's attracted a lot of popularity on the left. But what's happened is that people on the far right have picked up on this. They've conflated this group, Refuse Fascism, with the Antifa, with the anti-fascist groups, and they're claiming these really outlandish things, that a civil war is going to start on that day, that Antifa groups are going to start killing white people, they're going to start killing you know, legislators, they're going to attack churches, they're going to attack gun owners and all kinds of ridiculous things like that.
Well, the Refuse Fascism people are a front for the Revolutionary Communist Party, whose chairman, Bob Avakian, is sort of a bit like, you know, the dear leader in North Korea. He has this sort of dedicated following, but they're a far fringe group. They seem to have money. I don't know where the money comes from. They took out a full-page ad in the New York Times just a couple of days ago, which seemed more like an effort to recruit members to their cause as opposed to further the cause of getting rid of Trump and Pence. But what do you make of that group? I mean, you say it's pretty marginal, isn't it?
They're a marginal group. They've been around since the 1970s. They were engaged in a very strange incident in the late 70s when Deng Xiaoping came to the White House, and there was like fighting with the guards at the White House. But that was many decades ago. I mean, they are around. They're a permanent fixture in the American political scene. They're small, controversial. A lot of other left-wingers don't love to work with them. There are more members in Refuse Fascism. It's a combination of both RCP members of the Revolutionary Communist Party and other people who are working in this larger group. But it hasn't attracted a lot of, I mean, this is the thing, is that these are probably going to be, you know, a half dozen or a dozen demonstrations in areas where this group has followers and activists. And they're probably not going to attract, it's probably not going to attract a lot of attention. This isn't, again, it's not an issue that's become very popular. It's not a day of protest that's become very popular on the left. It's not an organic thing that's coming out of, you know, left-wing or progressive politics in America. It's one group calling for a certain day to do something. And then it being portrayed, you know, despite whatever this group's politics and beliefs are, it's being portrayed in a completely different way by the far right as like a day of murder and mayhem.
Well, but the right's always inflated the power of the left, and that's just pervasive. And, of course, the right's always been much, much better funded. I mean, rich people tend to be right-wingers, and they throw money at right-wing causes, whereas left-wing billionaires are quite fickle and few and far between. So the disparity is extraordinary between the wealth and power behind the right in terms of spreading insanity like Alex Jones and company than it is behind the left. And this far left fringe group, the Revolutionary Communist Party, I've tried to read their stuff, but it reads like North Korean stuff. It's this cult worshipping of Chairman Bob Avakian. Who is this guy and where does he get his money from to take out full page ads in the New York Times?
Well, they're a Maoist group. They have their Avakian was originally high up in the Students for Democratic Society, the big 1960s New Left group. And his group comes out of an earlier group called the Revolutionary Union that founded with the split up of SDS, and they became part of them became the RCP in 1975. He's affiliated with other Maoist parties around the world. They have their own way of talking that's very internal to the Maoist movement, which is gives it this strange way of them reading and writing stuff, very long sentences, slogans that go on and on. Where do they get money? I mean, they have supporters, and Refuse Fascism is bigger than just the parent party. So I don't know. I heard that they raised like $100,000 to take these ads out. Mm-hmm. It's certainly nothing compared to the amount of money that's being pumped into the alt-right by the Mercers and other families that giving, you know, people are giving money to Milo Yiannopoulos or Richard Spencer. And there's a funny thing. Part of the conspiracy theory about November 4th is that Soros is providing the money for it. It started mm-hmm. as $1.7 million, and then it started as $1.8 million, and then that became $18 million. Mm-hmm. Of course, Soros isn't providing any money for these demonstrations. Soros is actually an anti-communist who helped, subvert the Eastern European communist regime.
Sure.
But this isn't because he's a liberal. Even though he's a liberal anti-communist, he becomes a communist in the far right's eyes. So they often project what they're actually doing onto the left. So actually, they have millionaires and billionaires with deep pockets, and so they're always accusing the left of having these ties.
Right, and
I mean, all Refuse Fascism done is taken some ads out. That's not.
Right.
I mean, that is a chunk of money in papers, but that's not that much money in the big, national political picture.
Sure, sure. There's no comparison with the Mercers and right wing billionaires. They just open their checkbooks and throw money out. And Soros and company. Soros doesn't really give much money to left wing causes, and he hates political ideologues on the left and the right. So it's all a straw man that the right has managed. And David Horowitz, of course, is another one of these prodigal sons from the left who's made a fortune by being a prodigal son with these right wingers. So if you want to make money as a political activist, make that migration. Yeah, migrate from the left to the right, and they'll embrace you with billions. So how did this nonsense start, though? I mean, we mentioned that Alex Jones is spreading this idea that a civil war will begin on this coming Saturday in the United States, November the 4th, and Antifa has been inflated as the provocateurs on the left who are going to instigate this civil war by going out and killing Trump supporters and taking their guns away. None of these people on the far right, the alt-right, had even heard of Antifa, right? I mean, I hadn't heard of it until recently.
The Antifa stuff became popular again in the U.S. around in January because there was a large black bloc that was sort of branded as an anti-fascist bloc during Trump's inauguration. And then after the shutdowns, activists shut down Milo Yiannopoulos from speaking at Berkeley in February, and then, of course, after Charlottesville. So this has become the new boogeyman for the far right. I think what they're doing is taking their old anti-communist conspiracy theories, and now they're putting Antifa instead of the Communist Party. And so they just they already have the narrative there, they already have the talking points, and then they just rehash it. Alex Jones wasn't the first person to come up with this theory. There was it had been picked up by other people, and there was a video that actually went viral on Facebook, and it has almost 3 million views. It has over 3 million views. So like 1% of the population of the country has seen this video where a guy dressed up like a law enforcement officer, although he isn't, does a short video in his car where he claims that this is going to be the day that Antifa is going to start the Civil War, and that white people are going to be, he gives it a special racial tinge where he says that white people are going to be attacked, and he says police are going to be attacked and legislators are going to be attacked. So that's when it first got really popular. Alex Jones these days actually acts like a gatekeeper for conspiracy theories. He harvests them from other conspiracy theorists. So he and his people, I'm sure, watch all of these videos because YouTube and social media has made it so easy for any conspiracy theorist to have their own channel. You know, they don't have any need to have any capital startup, and people don't have any expectations of high production values. So all kinds of like do-it-yourself conspiracy theorists start on Facebook and YouTube. And I'm sure him and his people at InfoWars watch these things, and then they pick the ones that they like that are starting to percolate up, and they incorporate them into their own like brand of their conspiracy theory. And so he helped throw the ball further. Well, and just then other people then watch him, and then they interpret it themselves, and then they also elaborate on the conspiracy. Because it changes with each person who repeats it. It's like a game of telephone, and it gets more and more outlandish. The most absurd claim is that Antifa super soldiers are going to, on November 4th, attack like soccer moms and small business owners. This was an ironic tweet that some comedian wrote, but it got picked up seriously by the Gateway Pundit and spread further in the far-right media sphere.
Antifa super soldiers, wow. Well, just in closing, Spencer Sunshine, Donald Trump actually listens to Alex Jones. He's been on his radio and TV show, and they have somebody from InfoWars, I believe, has been accredited to the White House press corps. Do we know whether Donald Trump believes that a civil war is going to start on Saturday in the United States? He'll be, I think, in Hawaii or South Korea when this happens.
Well, he must believe it because he's leaving the country because he's so afraid, right?
I see. Well, you know, it's laughable, but it's serious because there's an awful lot of these people out there, and they have lots of guns, and they're completely deluded. And
that's the real danger, is that one of these deluded far-right activists, if they want to come and counter-protest, that's their right. But I'm worried that one of these deluded far-right activists is going to take this stuff literally and show up to a demonstration with guns and go and try to murder, you know, a left-wing protester because they believe the Civil War is starting. In reality, they're the ones. The right isn't getting, it's encouraging its own people to take vigilante action and to take violent action. That's what's happening. And I'm afraid that there's going to be somebody on the right who's going to do something dangerous.
Well, Spencer Sunshine, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks again for having me on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Spencer Sunshine, who's a researcher and activist whose research interests includes U.S. white nationalism, post-war fascism, particularly third position and European new right politics, left-right crossover movements, and left-wing anti-Semitism. As an activist, he's worked on issues regarding anti-fascism, police misconduct, prisoners' rights, global trade agreements, and environmental issues. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the hearings that took place in the last few days on Capitol Hill, where representatives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter were grilled by lawmakers. But it won't be long, 'cause kids with guns, easy does it, easy does it, they've got something to say.
Protect yourself from digital decay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining me in the studio is Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communication management and digital media entertainment. He began his career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize, Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Mark Rotenberg, who is the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory boards, including the Expert Panel on Cryptography Policy and Computer Security for the OECD and the Legal Experts on Cyberspace Law for UNESCO, and he chairs the ABA Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin and Mark Rotenberg.
Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us, Mark. And let me begin with you, because you were at there were three congressional hearings over the last couple of days in Washington. I believe you were in attendance for the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. My take on it, just from looking at the visuals on television, it looks almost like the spokespeople or the delegates, if you will, from Google and Facebook look like sacrificial lambs.
Well, I don't know if sacrificial lambs is the best characterization. I think there is genuine concern about the way that the Russian government exploited the social media platforms during the 2016 election. And it's not so much, of course, about, you know, litigating the outcome of that election, but a very strong concern on the part of both political parties that similar attacks, perhaps worse attacks, could happen in the future, and the company seems surprisingly blasé about it. I recall several exchanges where a senator said to one of the general counsels who was testifying, you know, what are you planning to do? How do we know this won't happen again in the future? And there were surprisingly long pauses. So I think it's an important accounting that took place this week in Washington, and an understanding that increasingly these companies need to take a lot more responsibility for what happens online.
And Jonathan, I thought that the fact that Zuckerberg wasn't there spoke volumes.
Yeah, I think what's really fascinating to me is that in past times when a large corporation has been called on the carpet of Congress, such as the tobacco companies or others, the drug companies, the CEOs have always shown up. And the very fact that the CEOs of Google, Facebook, and Twitter didn't bother to even come says that they don't take this very seriously. They think somehow they can escape regulation the way they've escaped it for 30 years now. And I don't think they read it right. I think that there is real anger. I recall Angus King saying, I'm disappointed you're here and not your CEOs, to the general counsel of Facebook. And I think that sense that they just blew them off was a misreading of the gravity of the issue. And I totally agree with Mark that this is something that they're going to have to grapple with.
And Mark, Dianne Feinstein have said, we're not going to go away, gentlemen. This is a very big deal. You created these platforms and now they're being misused and you have to be the ones to do something about it or we will. Do you think that got their attention?
Well, it certainly did. I mean, there's a growing sentiment in Washington that the, you know, honeymoon with Silicon Valley has clearly come to an end. And this is true most clearly with the Democrats who, you know, for many years said to Silicon Valley, you know, leave the internet alone, self-regulation works, which we thought throughout this period was not very sensible or responsible. And of course, you know, now we all live with the consequences of that. But I think there's no doubt, particularly in the comments from Senator Feinstein and Senator Harris as well, the two senators from California were both among the most critical members of the various committees that conducted oversight, that things are going to change.
And Jonathan Taplin, one of the more alarming revelations for the public was that we were originally told that there about 10 million Americans were influenced by Russian internet propaganda, much of it quite ugly and divisive. But it turns out it's more like 150 million. My understanding is, and I've never been able to get any clarity on this, that when Facebook, they had human curation of their news, and there was a pressure from Republicans, and I'm not sure who and what groups, that floated this canard that Facebook had a liberal bias in their curation of the news. And given that between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans get their news from Facebook, this is a big deal. And under this pressure, whether it was real or staged, they capitulated and got rid of the human curation and moved to algorithms. That seems to be a significant landmark to my mind.
I think it's a really critical landmark. Needless to say, if someone posted Donald Trump was endorsed by the Pope, a human curator could have found out in about 2 seconds that that wasn't true. But the computer algorithm doesn't know that. And so my feeling, quite honestly, was that Steve Bannon and Cambridge Analytica was essentially waiting for their attack on Facebook to take effect. From early February on, they were constantly hammering Facebook that there was a bias against conservative news on the trending topics. For your listeners, trending topics is what determines what goes to the top of your Facebook newsfeed. By removing the humans from that, and that happened on May 23rd, 2016, and you can look at a chart of when fake news really took off, and that is literally the day it took off. Because once you had no humans there, then it was possible to put up any kind of fake post, hit it with lots of bots, which they had at their disposal from Russia, Eastern Europe, and other places, and force it to the top of the trending topics thing, and then that in turn got it onto everybody's newsfeed. So, I mean, whether, you know, Peter Thiel, who was on the board of Facebook, participated in that decision, and obviously Peter Thiel was at that point fairly getting involved with the Trump campaign, or not, it's still a question that is unanswered as to why that happened. And the funny thing is these companies claim they're not publishers. They have lived under the safe harbor provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act since 1998. And that makes it impossible for people to sue them. There was a case they lost just recently of this father of a young man who was killed by jihadists who was raised on YouTube jihadist propaganda. Google's response was, well, we don't have any responsibility for this. We're just the pipe. But the point is, they're not just a pipe. Facebook admitted under questioning from Ted Cruz that they are not a neutral platform in the sense that they make a conscious selection of what news gets to send to what person. And so in that sense, even if the editor is an algorithm, it's no different from the editor of the Los Angeles Times. And so this ability to hide behind safe harbor seems to me be one of the big problems that is going to have to be looked at.
And Mark Rotenberg, I'd like your comments on what Jonathan has said, but I'd also want to add that Google was asked why they didn't take immediate action regarding RT's preferred status in their search engines in light of the intelligence community's assessment in January of 2017 of RT's role in terms of Russian propaganda.
Right. Well, I thought that was a particularly interesting exchange. I mean, what was unstated in the response from Google, of course, was that, you know, that was a profitable advertising relationship for Google, and Google was promoting RT in part because RT was generating a lot of clicks for Google. So there's no doubt that the commercial incentives are structured in a way that essentially reward effective propaganda, and that was also a problem that was implicated during the course of the hearing. I wanted to just make a couple of other points. I think, you know, Jonathan is right, of course, about the safe harbor provisions, but there's also very important in this debate Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is what has given the Internet platforms this extraordinary immunity from liability for publication. It's an immunity that exceeds, you know, what a newspaper has or even a bookstore or library. And I frankly am feeling a little guilty about this. I was involved in the early debates over Section 230 and later defended it in our briefing for the Supreme Court in ACLU versus Reno. And at the time that we were supporting 230, you know, we thought of the Internet as a distributed network, that there were a lot of electronic online resources, bookstores and newsstands and libraries all moving onto the Internet, and we needed this kind of protection to protect the platforms to enable access to a distributed information network. But what I think Jonathan has done so very well in his recent book is make clear that over time, of course, the information industry has largely collapsed into the major platforms, and we're now almost entirely dependent on Google and Facebook as our gateway to get access to online information. And it's for that reason, it's because of the structural change in the architecture of the Internet and where the information resides today, that I think we need to revise 230, because the protection which was put in place originally to enable distributed online access to information has, in fact, over time led to the consolidation of information access, and that's quite troubling.
And Jonathan, my understanding is that RT is second to CNN in terms of YouTube viewers.
Yeah, RT has a huge traffic on YouTube, and as Mark points out, it's a very remunerative relationship. You notice that the Google General Counsel would not disclose how much money Google has paid to RT for advertising on its network. He tried to completely obfuscate about that point, but it's probably a considerable amount of money that's been paid. And, you know, Facebook refused to even say how much money they made from political advertising during the course of the election, even though it's probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
And Mark, let's turn to what Jonathan was talking earlier about Cambridge Analytica, Stephen Bannon, the Mercers, etc., influencing the elections. There are two schools of thought. There is the idea that Facebook offered up their tools to both Republicans and Democrats, and that the Trump campaign took advantage of it. And even had Facebook people inside the Trump campaign, physically inside the Trump campaign, and that somehow Hillary's people gave them the back of their hand and weren't interested. That's one school of thought. The other is, for example, people like the former head of the CIA, Brennan, and Mark Morrell, the former acting director of the CIA, both have said that there's no way that they believe the Russians have that analytic capability in terms of targeting social media and psychological profiles of American citizens, and that the argument is that what happened was that there was some kind of collusion between Cambridge Analytica, who provided the data, whereas the Russians provided the amplification via bots and troll farms.
All right, well, I think the short answer at this point in time is that we don't know for certain what the extent was of cooperation between the Trump campaign and Cambridge Analytica and the Russian troll farms, which were clearly acting to try to defeat Hillary Clinton and promote a very divisive social unrest in the U.S. Sometimes I think you get into situations involving conspiracies where there's essentially an understanding between two parties and they proceed on two paths, somewhat looking over their shoulder at the other just to make sure that everyone's doing what they thought they would do, but there's very little explicit communication. And that could well be the case here. In other words, there could have been enough of an understanding about what the Trump people would do and what the Russian people would do to exploit Facebook to produce an outcome that both sides saw as mutually advantageous without any one sitting down and saying, well, this is how we're going to target these congressional districts, and that requires these messages from, you know, the Internet Research Agency that was being managed by the Russians.
Sure, and that would be a much smarter approach than George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, who appear to have not been the most skillful of spies, if that's indeed, if they were involved in espionage. And again, let me remind the audience, we're speaking with Mark Rotenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C., and Jonathan Taplin, the Founder and Director Emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, and author of the new book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Now, back to the absence of Mark Zuckerberg, he originally, Jonathan, tried to give this whole issue the back of his hand by dismissing it as crazy. Now he's had to sort of revise that a little and admit that something's happened. But Sheryl Sandberg spoke with Axios, and I thought was pretty vacuous. So what's your sense of when we'll get some real answers, if not action, from these people?
Well, I think both Klobuchar and Warner yesterday were pretty clear that they were not going to let Facebook and Google get away with the notion that they could self-regulate. As Klobuchar put it, you know, the management could change in 6 weeks and all of a sudden someone just said, well, we're not going to do anything. So I think, and I would defer to Mark, who's in Washington and has got his finger on the pulse, but my sense is that this act of the Safe Online Ads Act that Warner, Klobuchar, and McCain have put forward might get some real traction. Now, I don't think it's going to solve the whole problem because, as we've all talked about, the ads part of this propaganda information is only part of it. And as you pointed out, Ian, 125 million people saw organic posts which were boosted by bots and were not specifically ads, but they were propaganda. So determining what's an ad and what's just propaganda is going to be tricky. The thing that I think could be regulated is some sense of, you know, this station is not allowed to broadcast stuff that it knows to be untrue. And so that notion of understanding the difference between the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, which anyone could have figured out was not true, and something that is more nuanced in terms of Hillary Clinton is going to open the borders, is a question, you know? And so I think really the question that we have to wrestle with is, are the existing regulations, of which there are very few, useful, or do we need to revisit the safe harbor? Do we also need to revisit the issues that Mark has been talking about more than anybody, which is privacy regulation? Because needless to say, some of this comes down to their ability to know everything about you. You know, when Senator Kennedy was questioning the Facebook person and said, just as a hypothetical, if your CEO wanted to know everything about Senator Graham, what movies he liked, you know, where he's gone on vacation, you could do that, couldn't you? And then the GC said, oh, no, no, we would never do that. He said, and Kennedy said, I'm not asking you what the rules are. I'm saying, could you do it? And then, of course, the guy just completely fumfered around and didn't answer the question. Of course they know that, because at the whole core of their advertising strategy is having 200 billion individualized profiles of people that can be targeted.
And Mark Rotenberg, what's your sense of what can be done about what is known as surveillance capitalism?
Well, that in and of itself is, of course, a great phrase, and I guess goes right to the, you know, privacy concerns that we and others have been talking about. But I do want to come back to Jonathan's point about the regulation of online advertising, particularly around electoral politics, because I think progress can be made. The legislation that was introduced, it's bipartisan, so you have Klobuchar and you have Warner and you have McCain, basically trying to establish more transparency. And now you have the Federal Election Commission, which is in the midst of a rulemaking, basically revisiting the exemption that they had given the online industry for election-related advertising. I think that's going to change. I will provide what, you know, increasingly to us seems to be one of the key techniques of accountability here, and that is that we actually need a lot more transparency around the advertising techniques. And if someone receives an ad, particularly because these ads are micro-targeted and they're based on demographics and they're based on characteristics unique to particular users, we think that you have an absolute right to know how that ad was generated. You get to see, in fact, or should get to see, in fact, the exact same information that the advertiser provided to Facebook, which categories you fall into, you know, what is the entity that has paid for the ad, how many times are you going to see this. We would draw a line, I think, for First Amendment reasons between paid for advertising, which should, as a general matter, be accountable associated with elections, and the speech of users online, which may in effect say the same thing, but that actually is where the strong First Amendment interest kicks in. So if there's, you know, people expressing views that may seem, you know, like propaganda and so forth, that's actually not something the FEC should be regulating. But when advertisers are you know, being paid to promote to particular users particular political messages, that absolutely can be regulated. And a bit ironically, talking about innovation and the benefits of the internet economy, I think we could do this more effectively with companies like Facebook and Google than we have with traditional you know, media like, you know, print and radio and TV and so forth, precisely because we actually know a lot more about what the advertisers are trying to accomplish.
Hey, Mark, can I ask you a question about this bright line that you're trying to draw between paid advertising and what we could call organic posts? So the example was put forth of this Russian front group called Heart of Texas. So this was a group that was supposedly being very patriotic around Texas and worried that the Islamists were going to take over, create Sharia law. So they started, it was an internet research agency front created by them. They start by advertising. And then if people liked their post, then once you liked your post, you're going to see everything that they post, whether it's an ad or just an quote-unquote organic post. This is still a propaganda organization. Now, do they get all the First Amendment protections that you're asking for in that sense, even though it's a complete fake front organization for the internet, Russian Internet Research Agency?
Well, it's an excellent question, and you know, part of my answer is that this is really the first time the FEC or Congress has confronted these issues, and we're trying to do the best job to simultaneously address the need to regulate this activity while respecting the First Amendment. And I do think that a workable first draft says, well, let's draw a line between, you know, the paid-for advertising where there's an entity that is expressing a political view for money, and there's another entity that's receiving money to propagate that political view. We think that conduct can be regulated. But if it is subsequently reposted by a user online who says, gee, I really agree with this and I want all my friends to be aware of it, I think that's an entirely different type of activity.
I totally agree. Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's how we would do it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to get both of you to talk about the broader context of national security, since this is so much a part of national security, in terms of the idea that the Russians may well have chosen our president for us, and that next time around, unless something is done, they could be screwing with our elections even more. There's no question that the Russians have developed hybrid warfare, and a big part of hybrid warfare is information warfare, which they seem to have stolen the march on us. There's obviously an asymmetry here. You have RT having a lot of influence here in the country, both influencing the far right and the far left. But we don't have anything in Russia that does anything to prick the massive bubble of information that Putin has sealed most of his population inside of. So beginning with you, Jonathan, what can be done in terms, or do you think that we at the American public is not sufficiently aware of this broader context in terms of hybrid warfare, information warfare? It's going to get worse into the future, obviously.
I would think that it's probably the most serious issue we have to confront. And, you know, information warfare is not just being waged by the Russians. It's being waged by ISIS. And certainly the man who drove his car into all those bicyclists on Monday was a man who was originally radicalized by information warfare, by propaganda from ISIS that he saw online on YouTube. So the question is, have we unilaterally disarmed in information warfare with this safe harbor provisions, which, as Mark points out, may be slightly outmoded and may need some revisiting? That, to me, would be the issue that maybe should be examined first.
And Mark, what are your thoughts on that broader context?
You know, this has been an interesting year for us. Obviously, EPIC has long been associated with our privacy work and open government litigation, but we actually decided shortly after the election to refocus on protecting democratic institutions, because without strong democratic institutions, a lot of these debates we've had over the years on privacy and civil liberties really won't amount to much. And, you know, to be a little bit more precise, we actually have a series of cases now that try to understand not only the Russian involvement in the 2016 election, but also the response of the various federal agencies, including the FBI, whether they did what they were supposed to do. We have an open government case to try to obtain the complete January report from the Director of National Intelligence, which first described Russian meddling, and we think more of that information should be available to the public. But I think the larger point, and answer to your question, Ian, is that this is going to happen again. It's going to happen because this is a unique vulnerability of U.S. political society. We are very easy to reach online through the media platforms, and it is very easy to influence people's opinion. And I think we need to find a way to enable the connectivity while at the same time making sure that there aren't distortions that undermine democratic institutions.
Well, Mark Rotenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And Jonathan Taplin, likewise, I thank you for joining us.
Nice speaking with you.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Rotenberg, who's the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C., and Jonathan Taplin, who's the Founder and Director Emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. He's the author of the new book just out, Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.